Right. Okay, so I did the wrong thing. And that is why you did not hear the usual lead-in with the countdown and everything. And the reason for that is that I'm still a little shook up from my near-death experience an hour ago. So when I say, by the grace of God, I'm here to give you the last live A Step Farther Out show of the year, I'm not kidding. So an hour ago, I was over, so I keep some of my stuff, various things, in a storage locker. It's nicer than most. It's more of an office space, really. It's got power outlets, it's got lights, it's got air conditioning and heating, at least nominally. Anyway, I was over there to retrieve one of my spare Laserdisc players. Because basically to take to the Dallas Makerspace with me for my traditional anime Oshogatsu, which is what I do on New Year's. I'll go over there and play anime and make hot chocolate until the wee small hours, starting sometime afternoon and continuing until whenever. Anyway, so that was the plan. So I'd gone over there and I started to move a rolling shelving unit, and it collapsed onto me. A shelving unit holding hundreds of kilograms of stuff, some of it quite fragile. But the one of the casters, right, it's got four casters at the four corners, and they're screwed in with fairly heavy bolts. Well, one of those bolts simply sheared off. And the shelving unit started to collapse onto me. Anyway, I managed to get it stabilized and pick up the stuff that had fallen off onto the floor, and I didn't get crushed to death, which is a good thing. That would have been a real, real shitty holiday for everybody who, you know, cares about me, of whom I am assured there are three or four in the world. Because the other thing was, on account of the fact that there was somebody moving a bunch of stuff, and so my access to the sign-in sheet at the entrance had been blocked, I hadn't bothered to sign in, so there's no record, formally speaking, of my being there. It would have been a matter of, oh gosh, you know, they're going to lock up and leave, and it's like, huh, whose car is this? I don't know. You know, because there are some parked cars that are parked there sort of indefinitely. And if they didn't bother to go, you know, look around everywhere, they might not have, you know, noticed me crushed under the falling shelving in it. So that would have been bad. But I didn't get crushed by the falling shelving in it and killed. So that's pretty much a win as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, first priority in the new year, I think, is going to be to replace all four casters, because I'm not going to just replace the one and give the other three a chance to do the same thing. But, of course, that'll have to wait a while anyway. So yes, that was kind of a harrowing experience. I don't know, chatter and come about trying to build a rainwater pipe, a gutter, out of beer cans. I'm not really certain why one wouldn't simply use a pipe, but it's beyond me. I mean, rain gutters are a thing. Matter of fact, I guess you don't always even have to use a pipe to get water to flow in the direction you want. In Bavaria, I've noticed that many houses have lengths of chain from the eaves down to some convenient spot, because the rainwater, having collected on the roof, will then preferentially flow down the chain rather than simply flowing off at the roof at one random spot or another. Anyway, so what was I going to talk about today? Well, I suppose part of what I was going to talk about on this, oddly enough, considering I had a, you know, piece of metalwork shear off on me, was robustness and fragility. Because, you know, the other week I was complaining about so-called AI and smartphones and that kind of thing. And I'm sure somebody's thinking, you're an old curmudgeon at the right tender age of 40, aren't you? And I may be, but the thing is, I was sort of giving myself a mental comparison and saying, well, if you look at other things which very rapidly became an integral part of life, things like railroads and electrification and telephones, all of those were managed in ways that added robustness. You know, the early railroads were not particularly robust. Early electric systems were not robust. Early telephone systems were not robust. But as they became more and more important in people's lives, immense amounts of engineering effort, immense amounts of capital investment were put into, and personnel training and all these other things, were put into making sure that when you needed it, it would be there for you. Put into making sure that it wasn't just going to randomly break and strand you in the middle of nowhere, and so on. You know, I encountered an article from more than 100 years ago about a guy brooding chickens, an electrically heated and ventilated chicken brooder operation in Oklahoma. And you say, is it rural Oklahoma? I'd say any part of Oklahoma practically is rural. But, you know, it was not in downtown Oklahoma City or Norman or Tulsa. Right. So the guy was at least some distance out in the country. And there was great stress laid on the fact that if the ventilation system broke down for 20 minutes, the chicks would suffocate, right? So the electric company had to give him great assurances that his electric supply would be stable. Well, as you know, this past year I've had 18 and 36-hour power outages here at the house. And I am in a major city. So we've suffered a serious loss of robustness in something that used to be more robust. But when I look at things like smartphones, I note that there's no attempt to make them robust. There's no attempt to make them work well. That they're patched and pieced together. Right, the software is created by the use of frameworks that the people using it don't understand, which are, in many cases, quite slapdash in construction. And in many cases, there's, you know, somebody's proof of concept implementation, which was never meant for serious use, gets picked up and used seriously. And so there's sort of a variety of problems that arise in that regard, that no one has put serious effort into making the smartphone world one which is physically robust or robust as a matter of, you know, software, matter of the intangible components that it relies upon so much. And that's one of the reasons why, right, without which your smartphone is simply a glowing brick that gets hotter and hotter until it probably catches on fire. And that's one of the reasons that I say, you know, this is different from previous rapid adoptions. But the other thing is, as I've said, it's been pushed almost entirely by marketing. You know, I open the Wall Street Journal and they talk about how Xiaomi and Huawei are trying to introduce battery electric cars. They're trying to get into the market ahead of Apple's car and just talking about, well, battery electric car, basically a smartphone on wheels. And I'm thinking, well, that's the last thing that I want, because cars kill people. I mean, they kill people all the time. They kill people every day. In the United States, this past year, for example, cars have killed at least 70 people a day, right, across the country. Now, just imagine what happens if your phone, car, thing decides to update while you're going down the road at 100 kilometers an hour. What if it decides that, you know, the current new OS is incompatible with the brakes? And this is not me coming up with far-fetched scenarios, right? You can easily envision this happening, because there is, in the smartphone world, nothing resembling effective quality control, right? Nothing resembling the kind of testing that you need to make sure that things are safe and effective. In fact, the people who develop these things run away from that stuff as rapidly as possible. They see it as not only expensive, but as limiting what they want to do. And in a world of literally killing people, maybe limitations on what you want to do are appropriate. You know, similarly, the Wall Street Journal getting all upset about the whole business with Apple trying to include a heart monitor in its new smartwatch and or blood oxygen monitor, and the U.S. court system saying, hey, wait a second, that's infringes, right? And I'm saying I don't want a medical device, right? I don't want an Apple medical device. Apple Maps, right? People have already died as a result of relying on Apple Maps. Now imagine if Apple is running your pacemaker. Now imagine, you know, your diabetes insulin pump, right? Things that, if they go wrong, you might die. Or things that, if it keeps giving you a false indication, you'll start ignoring the indication, and then when you really need that indication, you don't have it because you've learned to ignore it. All kinds of things like that, right? If you're going to make something critical to people's lives, you have to build robustness into it, right? And, you know, and of course I've said I think that's something people don't properly appreciate about nuclear energy facilities, the amount of robustness that truly is built into them. You know, that was my father's comment about the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. He said, they put so much damn concrete and steel into the thing that no matter how wrong you did everything, it still didn't get out and hurt anybody. And that's the kind of design philosophy I think that we probably need more of, not less of. You know, the fact that you can just push an update, right, in a network-connected computer system, you can just push an update to create a new feature, to change an old feature, to eliminate an old feature that lots of people were depending on, and so suddenly they get up and the thing that they were doing for 4 years doesn't work anymore, or all their pictures are gone, or whatever, right? That does not compensate for robustness. That's a key, right? And the phone company, you look at, you know, yes, there was that running joke of we're the phone company, we don't have to care, right? But still, when you actually look at what AT&T did in the United States, for example, you know, the introduction of the touch-tone phone, the introduction of special dialing services, these were done in a manner to make sure that the people who got a touch-tone phone would be able to call other telephones. Things like that. When they introduced new features like direct dialing, right? Direct long-distance dialing. You no longer had to have an operator place your long-distance call. That was a big change. And they went to great efforts to make sure that in at least 99% of cases, when you dialed a long-distance call, it would ring the number you were dialing. Whether or not that kind of thing happens, it seems to be indifferent to the makers of the modern data appliance. And I find that very interesting, but also very concerning. Right, and it's that basis that I'm extremely dubious of the so-called AI, not simply because the claims made for it or about it are meaningless, essentially, but that it adds another layer of fragility to something that is already immensely fragile, and yet at the same time, billions of people are depending on it moment by moment. It's a bad combination, isn't it? Right, and so when we hear, for example, from Britain, the British Library is kaput, for want of a better description. How did this happen? Well, you know, a library is two things. It's a collection of books, and it's a collection of finding aids. And years ago, librarians started junking card catalogs in favor of electronic systems that would tell them where the books were, whether they were checked out or not, and so on. Well, here's the thing. In many cases, they discarded the physical card catalogs, which were large and bulky. And a card catalog, a physical card catalog, every card has a number. So if some vandal came and took all the cards out of the drawers and dumped them over the floor, you could, it would take time and effort, but you could pick up all those cards and re-sort them into the correct order, and you'd have your library again, right? Without the catalog, you don't have a working library. Without an ability to find out which books are actually on the shelves and where they are on the shelves and retrieve them so that people can use them, you don't have a library. You have a warehouse full of paper, which is a very different thing. And that's the situation with the British Library at the moment. Due to a ransomware attack, they somehow have lost all of this. Now, what I want to know is, do you not have off-site backup tapes for everything? Because it seems as though you ought to be able to just go back and reinstall all the software, and presumably you have notes saying what software you have, how to install it, what patches it needs for the system you're actually running it on, and then get the off-site backup tapes and read them out and have your system back up. But this happened in October, and they're still not operating. How is this possible? I don't know, and I don't understand it, but I do have a guess, which, if it's not applicable to this specific case, I'm sure it's applicable to many cases, and it winds up being something that folks on SDF are often concerned about. And so, yeah, I'm talking about computers in this episode, which is very unusual for me. I always say I try to mostly not talk about computers because most people are talking about computers so much of the time. But I think that this is an interesting example of how modern life is structured. So my suspicion here, and somebody can correct me, right? Somebody can tell me what the straight dope is, what the true case is. But when you have software from a commercial vendor that you have to pay for, quite frequently there are locks in it to stop you from using the software if you haven't paid. There are all kinds of mechanisms to stop you from using the software. So some malicious person who gets into your system does not have to be able to create a way of stopping you from using the software. All that person has to do is to activate the one that's already there. You know, it's often said that backdoors built into software are dangerous not only because of what the people who are supposed to use them might do with them, right? Law enforcement decides, oh, well, we're going to use this backdoor to just find out everything that's on your system, but also because if there is a way into the system that you, the user, are not supposed to know about, and somebody knows about it, that knowledge is not going to stay contained. There will be somebody with more or less malice who finds out about it and is then able to use it. And so, as it turns out, it's very likely, you know, people say free and open source software is more secure because it has better auditing, right? Anybody can look at the code and see, oh, well, that doesn't make any sense. What does it do? But it's also true that free and open source software normally doesn't have these mechanisms built into it to stop the user from using it. And if it doesn't have those mechanisms, then a malicious person cannot exploit them. And so I think that many businesses which rely on computer software in their operations should take a long, hard look at whether proprietary software is really the best option, or whether they should be paying, right, because they should be paying developers, obviously, but they should be paying to develop free and open source software. Yes, you might lose some kind of competitive advantage, but you are very likely not to, well, I would say you're less likely to lose your whole business. I don't know. Is that reasonable? Do I know what I'm talking about? It's an open question. But I will say that, as part of my contention that what's called AI isn't artificial intelligence in any identifiable sense of the term, One of the things that struck me most was seeing an advertisement for a course in prompt engineering. Now, you may ask yourself, what the devil is prompt engineering? Well, I think it's the best proof that so-called AI is not, after all, artificially intelligent. You know, I mentioned before the person who came into a bookstore and asked for The Shrunken White Elephant of Style, and after 15 or 20 minutes, the people at the bookstore put their heads together and realized that what he might want was Strunken White's The Elements of Style. Now, that's what happens when you give a query to an actually intelligent system. In the so-called artificially intelligent system, however, they have you doing the reverse. They have you, the actually intelligent system, constantly changing and refining what you feed into the so-called artificially intelligent system so that it produces results more like the ones you want. This strikes me as proof that the thing is not doing as advertised. It's not behaving in an intelligent manner. Quite the opposite. And again, what do I know about this, right? What do I, you know, what I'm not the expert on this, but it does seem to me that there is a great deal of hype, right? A great deal of promotion, and not a great deal of substance, which, again, leads to the question, should you be relying on this? Should you be basing anything that actions are taken on the basis of, right? Should you be basing it on this? Should you be putting this kind of thing in charge of anything? And, you know, talking about systems that are specifically built to break, right? There's a big scandal in Poland right now because apparently a manufacturer of railway equipment, locomotives, programmed the computer controllers in these locomotives such that if you took the locomotive to the shop of a competitor, that the locomotive would stop working. That's a pretty egregious example because, of course, if this is true, right, if you set up something like that, there is certainly nothing to stop someone coming along with a GPS signal spoofer, because they certainly do exist, and simply feeding in the signal that will say, oh no, I'm at the competitor's shop, I've got to shut down and not work again. And you do that while train is going down the main line at 150 kilometers an hour, and suddenly there's a big, big problem. Now, imagine that multiplied by hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of cars, which, instead of having a fairly basic microcontroller set up, which somebody can go through all the code looking for traps and so on, instead are built around gigahertz processors and gigabytes of RAM and immense quantities of machine-generated code, which no one has ever looked at. No one has the least idea what it does or how it works, because it's generated by a framework that sits on top of another framework that sits on top of another framework. And I know, I say again, compare that with what we do in nuclear power plants, what's traditionally been done in space. You know, one of the things I worry about with SpaceX is that they seem to think that if it's good enough for Tesla, it's good enough for us, in terms at least of user interfaces. Now, is their flight control system much more thoroughly debugged and vetted and examined? I imagine it is. I think you'd pretty much have to. But, you know, the touchscreen interface in the Dragon capsule doesn't give me all that much confidence as to what's behind it, because it doesn't really give me the confidence that somebody thought, well, what happens if there's an electrical fault and the light backlighting of the screen turns off? What happens if we're depressurized and somebody has to use this in a glove? You know, and it's not that these are things that never happen or never can happen. Because, again, the Apollo 12 launch, back in December of 1969, a lightning bolt hit the capsule and popped the circuit breakers in the electrical systems. And Al Bean was able to reach up and flip the switch, SCE to AUX, and bring the system back up. But that was because it was a relatively simple system, and most of what was in it was hardwired, so that it didn't have a long boot cycle to go through, for example. If it had, they would certainly never have made it to the moon. What else is there to say? Well, mostly, let's have a glorious future year of 2024, right? What else is there to say? Let's try to have a better year next year than we've had this year. Let's try for some peace on earth, goodwill to men. I know it doesn't seem easy. I keep harping on this idea that we have all the tools that we need to make a better world. Now what we have to do is use them rightly. And one of the aspects of that is having hope. I've said repeatedly that in my opinion, the old saw that people get the government they deserve in a democracy isn't really right. That in a democracy, or in most systems, people get the government they expect. As long as people expect it to be crap, it's going to be crap. As long as people expect war, they're going to have war. As long as people expect things to go badly, then things will go badly. Let's try expecting better. Because, yes, our expectations are likely to be disappointed, but the better we expect, the better the disappointments will be. You know, people sometimes say, you know, shoot for the stars, then even if you miss, you're on the moon or something like that. Anyway, expect better, and even when your expectations are disappointed, the outcomes will be better. A special note that, once again, the post office, a parcel arrived at the Fort Worth Sorting Center, and instead of sending it on to my post office box in Fort Worth, the Fort Worth Sorting Center sat on it for a couple of days and then decided to send it to Shreveport. And so the earliest that MNW's a long arm stapler. Think you're coming home, what's a girl like me to do alone tonight?
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are.